Martin, the first murder trial in Utah. Lee is quite a diverse person, as he tells me, and as his bio indicates, he has done a little bit of everything. He is the father of five children and scoutmaster in the Star Crest Ward. He's a 1984 graduate of the BYU Law School, and at this present time, he is the director and head of public services at the University of Utah Law Library. Lee has written on the codification movement in English and many other various and diverse subjects that would be of interest, I'm sure, to all of us. He became interested in this particular topic, the Egan murder trial, while searching for the original court documents for the Egan family at their request. I have read his paper, and it is one of the most interesting and stimulating pieces of work I have read in quite some time. We're also fortunate to have with us, making comments and responding to Lee's paper, L.K. Gillespie. Mr. Gillespie is chair of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Weber State University. He is also very well known in Utah writing circles because he has recently authored the book, The Unforgiven, Utah's Executed Man. Do we have any executed women?
No.
No executed women. Good enough. We appreciate you coming. I guess we could look at it that way, couldn't we? Lee, are you ready to thrill us with your work? Thank you.
Thank you. I think the women are better behaved than the men.
I think so.
The first session of an official court to convene in Utah Territory opened on Monday, October 6, 1851, with His Honor Judge Zerubbabel Snow presiding. District Attorney Seth M. Blair, U.S. Marshal Joseph L. Hayward, Court Clerk William I. Appleby were present. No business was conducted until the next evening when Judge Snow presented his commission from the President of the United States and Mr. Blair petitioned to impanel a grand jury, which petition was granted by the court. The first order of business for the grand jury was to hear witnesses to the suspected murder of one James M. Monroe by Howard Egan. The legal and social implications of this case are still a topic of discussion. Howard Egan had first arrived in the Salt Lake Valley as the captain of the 9th 10 in Brigham Young's Vanguard Company, returning in the fall of 1847 to winter quarters, and then bringing his family to the valley in 1848. Egan was born in 1815 in Ireland. His mother died when he was 8, and his father immigrated to Montreal. 5 years later, when his father died, he went to sea until the age of 23, when he married Tamsin Parsley and settled as a rope maker in Salem, Massachusetts. In 1842, the family was converted to Mormonism by Erastus Snow and moved to Nauvoo the same year. In Nauvoo, he continued rope making, but also worked as a bodyguard to Joseph Smith, as a member of the Nauvoo police, and as a major in the Nauvoo Legion. In 1849, Egan made the first of numerous trips from the Salt Lake Valley to the California gold fields. There he was engaged in the buying and selling of livestock and is listed in the court records as the keeper of a livery stable. After one such California trip, Egan returned to find that James Monroe, a schoolteacher who had been boarding in the Egan household, had seduced his wife Tamsin and sired a child, William M. Egan, who was born Friday the 13th of June, 1851. According to Orson F. Whitney, she gave her husband a penitent confession. Egan's reaction is recorded in the diary of Hosea Stout, quote, "I learned today that Howard Egan, who has returned from the gold mines lately, and upon learning that his wife had been seduced, or in other words, had a child willingly by James M. Monroe during his absence. Said Monroe had also gone to the States for goods for Reese and was now on his return here, whereupon Egan went and met him near Cache Cave and after talking the matter over some time, Egan drew a pistol and shot him dead, which makes the second man who has been deliberately shot dead for the same offense in less than 1 year in the territory. What will be the end of this last affair, I do not now know. End of quote. Congress had established the Utah Territory on September 9, 1850. By this act was brought into being governor, secretary, legislature, and a court system. The act provided for a Supreme Court consisting of a Chief Justice and two associate justices to meet annually at the seat of government. The territory was to be divided into three districts, each of which would be served by one of the justices who would reside and hold court within them. These justices were presidential appointees to serve for a four-year term. Probate courts and justices of the peace, both with limitations to their jurisdiction, were to be established by the legislature. On September 28, 1850, President Millard Fillmore appointed Brigham Young governor, B.D. Harris of Vermont, secretary, Lemuel G. Brandeberry of Pennsylvania, chief justice, Perry E. Brockes of Alabama, and Zerubbabel Snow of Ohio, associate justices, and Joseph L. Haywood of Utah, United States Marshal. Besides the Utahns, Justice Snow was also a Mormon. News of this action reached Brigham Young on January 27, 1851. He took his oath of office on February 3rd, and the transition from the provisional state of Deseret to the territory of Utah began in late March. When the federal officials arrived in July 1851, they inquired why the legislature had not been organized, prompting Governor Young to swiftly call elections. He also defined the judicial districts and assigned their judges. On September 8th, a special church conference was held for the purpose of sending a block of Utah stone as a contribution to the Washington Monument, which was then under construction. Federal community and church leaders sat together on the platform. Judge Brockes used the occasion to admonish Mormon women to become virtuous and insinuated that the Mormons were unpatriotic. Brigham Young asked Brockes for a public apology to the women, leading to a heated exchange of correspondence. Just one example, quote, "Your very expression tended to convey the assertion that those ladies you then and there addressed were prostitutes, unvirtuous. To that extent, you could only hope, but the probability was they were so far gone in wickedness, you dare not believe they could ever become virtuous. And now, sir, let your own good senses, if you have a spark left, answer, could you, had you mustered all the force that hell could lend you, could you have committed a greater indignity and outrage on the feelings of the most virtuous and sensible assemblage of ladies that your eyes ever beheld? If you could, tell me how." This exchange culminated in preparations for Brockes, Brandeberry, and Harris to leave the territory. Juanita Brooks gives a different explanation of events leading to the departure of the runaway judges. Quote, "The trouble stemmed from the fact that Brigham Young had taken the oath of office months before the other officers arrived. He had the census taken and called the legislature into session. The new secretary of the territory, Broughton D. Harris, insisted that the legislature could not be legally called without his signature and sealed. Hence, since they were not duly authorized, legislators should receive no pay for their services. To express their disapproval, the three federal officials decided to leave and did so on September 28, 1851. The runaway officials have been characterized, even by objective modern scholars, as political hacks, undistinguished, lacking moral integrity, and unable to command the respect of those whom they judged. Aware that the departure of the officials was imminent, the legislature met on September 24th and passed an act commanding the U.S. Marshal to take possession from Harris of the territorial seal, papers, and $24,000 in funds that had been appropriated for the territory for the reason that he refused to act in office or disperse any money. The Supreme Court, composed of Brandeberry and Brockes, granted an injunction allowing Harris to keep the items. Snow dissented on grounds that there was no law fixing the time and place for holding the Supreme Court, and that the district court, not the Supreme Court, had original jurisdiction. The legislature took a number of actions to repair the judiciary. On September 27, 1851, a joint resolution was passed legalizing the acts of the provisional government. On September 29th, Judge Snow was authorized to hold court in all three districts. On September 30th, a memorial was presented asking the president to fill the vacant positions. On September 29th provision, which was approved on October 4th, required Judge Snow to open the district court in Great Salt Lake City on the first Monday in October 1851, which was only 2 days away. His irritation at the hurried schedule is apparent in his October 10th opinion on the legality of enactments by the provisional government of Deseret and statutes so far enacted by the territorial legislature under the Organic Act, which was presented to the assembled governor, court, and legislature. At this same session of the court, the marshal returned the grand jury panel, and subpoenas were issued for witnesses George Moore, William Horner, James Wade, George C. Robbins, and Dominicus Carter to appear before it. On October 13th, the witnesses were sworn and presented to the grand jury, and a warrant for the arrest of Howard Egan was issued to answer an indictment found against him. Though Prosecutor Seth Blair's language sounds impossibly contorted and even comical to the modern ear, it was not uncommon for the time and leaves nothing to the imagination in its statement of the facts of the case. And I quote, "The grand jurors, for and in behalf of the United States, and in and for the territory of Utah, upon their oath, present that Howard Egan, of the county of Great Salt Lake, not having the fear of God before his eyes, on the 20th day of September in the year 1851, in the territory and county aforesaid, in and upon one James Monroe, in the peace of God, and then and there, being feloniously, willfully, and of his own malice aforethought, did make and assault with a certain pistol of the value of $25, then and there, being charged with gunpowder and a leaden bullet, which pistol he, the said Howard Egan, in his right hand, then and there, had and held against at and upon him the said James Monroe, then and there, feloniously, willfully, and of his own malice aforethought, did discharge and shot off, and that he, the said Howard Egan, with the leaden bullet aforesaid by force of the gunpowder aforesaid, out of the said pistol by him, the said Howard Egan, so as aforesaid, discharged and shot off at him, the said James Monroe, in and upon the right side of the nose, a little under the right eye of the said James Monroe, then and there did feloniously, willfully, and of his own malice aforethought, did strike and wound give to the said James Monroe, then and there, with the leaden bullet aforesaid out of the pistol aforesaid, as aforesaid, discharged and shot off in and upon the right side of the nose, a little under the right eye of the said James Monroe, one mortal wound of the breadth of 1 inch and depth of 7 inches, of which said mortal wound the said James Monroe did then and there die." It took a long time to shoot him. "And so the jurors aforesaid, upon their oath aforesaid, do say that the said Howard Egan did kill and murder the said James Monroe, in the manner aforesaid, feloniously, willfully, and of his malice aforethought, and against the laws, peace, and dignity of the United States. Signed, Seth M. Blair, S. M. Blair, U.S. Attorney for Utah Territory." Also indicted was an alleged accomplice, Thurston Larson. Egan was arraigned on October 14th and pleaded not guilty. A jury was summoned and witnesses were subpoenaed to testify against him. This day, W.W. Phelps and George A. Smith entered their appearance as defense counsel. These two had been admitted to practice on motion on October 7th. It does not appear that W.W. Phelps had ever practiced law before this occasion, but he was skilled at argument. Phelps was an educated man who had advocated by petition and in person on behalf of the persecuted Mormons to the governors of Missouri, Illinois, and Iowa on numerous occasions. He had served as a Nauvoo City Councilman on the Constitutional Committee of the Provisional State of Deseret, and most recently as a representative elected to the first territorial legislature. Apostle George A. Smith, on the other hand, though an eloquent and intelligent speaker, appeared much less confident, stating that he had never argued a case before. The case was, of course, notorious, and court was undoubtedly well attended when it came on for trial on October 17th. As Juanita Brooks points out, the killing was mentioned by many diarists. The trial occurred after church authorities had already exonerated Egan. One can only imagine the grief and shame of Tamsin Egan, who was spared summons as a witness. Instead, on W.W. Phelps' motion, the court appointed William Snow to present an interrogatory to her because of her, quote, being unable on account of indisposition to attend court and wishing her testimony to be taken in the case. The questions to be answered were, first, was you seduced in the year A.D. 1850 by one James Monroe? If so, under what circumstances, how often, where, in what month, and day of the month, if not positive as near as possible? Second, did you by reason of such seduction have a child by the said James Monroe? If so, how long after such seduction? Jury selection occupied most of the morning. The jury was composed of Daniel H. Wells, Truman O. Angel, George D. Grant, A. H. Raleigh, James Mulliner, Jacob F. Hutchinson, Joseph Busby, A. C. Brower, Rodney Badger, A. J. Stout, Richard Petit, and Morgan Phelps. Mr. Blair read the indictment and opened the prosecution, and William E. Horner was examined. Following an adjournment until 2 o'clock, George C. Robbins, James Wade, and George Moore testified for the prosecution, and William Kimball testified for the defense. No public record remains of the content of these exchanges. Lawyer Hosea Stout, who attended court to observe the trial, summarizes the evidence, quote, "From the evidence, it appears that while Egan was gone to the mines, Monroe seduced his wife, by whom she had a bastard child. Monroe had gone to the east for goods when Egan returned, who, upon learning the facts of the case, went to meet Monroe, who was on his return to this place with a train of goods for Sirs Reese and near Bear River. Egan met him some 10 miles this side, and calmly saluting each other, both apparently friendly, went some 100 yards from the corral, and appeared to talk peaceably some time, when Egan drew a pistol and shot him in the face on the right side of the nose, just below the eye. Monroe fell dead on the spot. When Egan mounted his horse, rode to the company, told his name, made a short speech, said what he did he'd done in the name of the Lord, that Monroe had seduced his wife, ruined his family, and destroyed his peace on earth forever, and that they would find him in this place, and then blessed them, and hoped that they would have a safe journey to the city, and rode off, informing those he overtook on the road what he had done. This is, in short, the evidence in the case." End of quote. No report is given of Seth Blair's summation and closing argument. Kenneth L. Cannon notes that Blair admitted that Monroe had fathered a child by Egan, but that this did not warrant Egan's killing him. Cannon also speculates that Blair argued for jurisdictional reasons that the shooting occurred outside the boundaries of Utah Territory, but the locations described by Hosea Stout appear to be well inside. Both W.W. Phelps and George A. Smith argued for the defense. Again, we know little of Phelps' closing, except that he used Bible history, Homer, Virgil, besides a large pile of law books and precedents to show that Egan was justified in his act. George A. Smith's plea, on the other hand, was widely reprinted, first appearing in the Deseret News, then at least twice in pamphlets, and finally in the Journal of Discourses. Smith pointed out to the jury the facts of the killing, the seduction, the illegitimate child, and the disgrace brought on the family. He appealed to the jury to disregard legal technicalities and look for simple truth and justice. He argued that Egan's act was an act of justice customary in the area and community as follows, quote, "I argue that in this territory it is a principle of mountain common law that no man can seduce the wife of another without endangering his own life. The principle, the only one that beats and throbs through the heart of the entire inhabitants of this territory, is simply this. The man who seduces his neighbor's wife must die, and her nearest relative must kill him. Smith also cited cases from New Jersey, Louisiana, and Kentucky, concluding that, quote, this is the common practice of the United States, that a man who kills the seducer of his relative is set free. Though arguing for mountain common law, Smith also explicitly rejected the common law of England and the law of states like Ohio that followed it, arguing that these laws, which may have force in old England, are totally inapplicable to plain mountain men. Under English common law, the remedy for seduction was a civil suit for damages. Of this he says, quote, character is not estimated, neither reputation, but the number of pounds, shillings, and pence alone bear sway. What is the reason that these civil suits are tried in this way? It is because the spirit that actually reigns in these rotten and overgrown countries is to prostitute female virtue. He concludes that, were I a juryman, I would lie in the jury room until the worms should draw me through the keyhole before I would give my verdict to hang a man for doing an act of justice, for the neglect of which he would have been damned in the eyes of the whole community. The Journal of the Court tells us that additional remarks were made to the court and jury by W.W. Phelps, followed by Seth Blair, prosecuting attorney, before Judge Snow's charge to the jury. Again, no record remains of them. Judge Snow's charge to the jury, however, was printed in full in the Deseret News immediately following the text of George A. Smith's argument, as well as in its subsequent reprints, including the Journal of Discourses. The judge begins by reminding the jury that an offender is to be punished, quote, by due course of law, but not otherwise, and emphasizing the right to a fair and impartial trial. His instructions are detailed and explicit as to what elements of the crime had to be proved. With regard to the seduction defense under mountain common law suggested by Smith, the judge was very pointed, quote, the law does not permit a person to take the redress of grievances into his own hands. The deceased may have seduced the defendant's wife, as he now alleges. Still, he had no right to take the remedy into his own hands. If, for seduction, the law inflicted the punishment of death, it would not justify nor excuse the injured party from guilt if he inflicted death without a judgment of the law to that effect, nor even with such a judgment, unless he be the officer of the law appointed for that purpose. If, as it is contended by the defendant's attorney, he killed Monroe in the name of the Lord, it does not change the law of the case. A man may violate the law of the land and be guilty, and yet, so far as he is concerned, do it in the name of the Lord. If the deceased did seduce the defendant's wife and begat a child with her, and if for this the defendant killed him, in law the killing was unlawful. It seems unlikely that the jury could have acquitted Egan under these instructions, given the evidence before them, unless they found that the prosecution had not met its burden of proof. That is, that there was some doubt as to the sufficiency of the evidence. However, the evidence seems uncontroverted. The second part of the instructions concerned the jurisdiction of the court, and the jury could have acquitted Egan much more easily for lack of jurisdiction, even if they found him guilty of the crime. As Judge Snow pointed out, the place in which the act was committed becomes material. The judge instructed that since the court was sitting in its capacity as a United States court and not as a territorial court, the jury could only convict if the crime occurred outside territorial boundaries where the United States had sole and exclusive jurisdiction. He said, quote, if you do not find the crime to have been committed there, but in the territory of Utah, the defendant for that reason is entitled to a verdict of not guilty, end of quote. Even if the court had been sitting as a territorial court, Egan could not have been convicted, for as Judge Snow commented many years later, quote, Egan was indicted after the organic law took effect and before any law had been passed authorizing the courts to punish for acts done or omitted. In this case, I held that no act done or omitted by a person could be punished by courts except such act or omissions had first been proscribed by statute. In other words, there was no common law offenses in this territory. Egan was acquitted. End of quote. The jury deliberated only for 20 minutes before Foreman Daniel H. Wells returned their verdict of not guilty. The jury did not state its reasons, and we can only speculate as to why they returned the verdict they did. Judge Snow's above assessment indicates that he believed they found on jurisdictional grounds. However, Hosea Stout must have thought otherwise, because he seems very uncomfortable with the verdict. Quote, "This is like to be a precedent for anyone who has his wife, sister, or daughter seduced to take the law into his own hands and slay the seducer." End of quote. There is a distinct possibility that the jury would have returned the same verdict had there been no jurisdictional problem, contrary to their instructions, as indicated by prevailing public sentiment and subsequent cases. So ended the Egan case, but not its repercussions. Beside the fact that we all love gunslinger drama and a good scandal, the Egan case retains its interest for both legal scholars and historians. For legal scholars, its interest lies in the definition and application of mountain common law and its implications for the rule of law versus vigilantism. Second, there is the interesting question of when and to what extent the common law of England became applicable in Utah Territory. Then there are considerations of the extent to which federal control could be extended in the territory and the problem of jurisdictional divisions between federal courts, territorial courts, and the Mormon ecclesiastical courts. According to Kenneth L. Cannon II, the Egan case spawned a long progeny of justifiable homicides. Just months before the Egan case, the Supreme Court of the Provisional State had acquitted Madison D. Hamilton for the shooting of Dr. John M. Vaughn in a less publicized case. After the Egan case, the legislature in 1852 passed a criminal seduction statute. Then, in 1868, William Hughes was acquitted for the shooting of his daughter's abductor. The Deseret Evening News editorialized that, quote, "public opinion in these mountains declares that a man who seduces a woman ought to pay the penalty with his life, and her nearest of kindred should bring him to account." Similar incidents are documented in and outside Utah, even past the turn of the century. Cannon notes that Utah followed a control of crime model of criminal process, emphasizing repression of crime through either courts or vigilantes, as opposed to the due process model, emphasizing courts and law enforcement. The question of the time and extent of adoption of the common law of England in Utah has interested a number of scholars. Firmage notes that despite popular belief, English common law was only adopted in America to the extent that it fit the needs of the adopting jurisdictions, and because circumstances in Utah differed so greatly, the common law of Utah, that is, precedent coming from the Utah courts, better fit its needs. Of course, the most common difference was the belief in plural marriage, and the common law criminalized marriage while a person had a living husband or wife. Other practices foreign to the common law dealt with apportionment of property, water, and natural resources on a communal basis. The Egan case is considered an open window on the early Mormon attitude toward law in general and common law in particular. The theme of England's corruption under the common law is recurrent throughout George A. Smith's plea. Brigham Young and other authorities adamantly opposed reception of the common law, characterizing it as a, quote, "labyrinth of abominations." In 1854, the legislature declared that the only authorities to be recognized in Utah were statutory, either enactments of the legislature or of Congress. This stricture was not abandoned until after statehood. The issues of federal control and divisions between church and governmental courts are discussed at considerable length in Firmage and Mangrum's book, Zion in the Courts. Their book documents the rise of the church court systems, resistance to governmental legal incursions into Mormon society, and the operation of the church court system as an alternative to the civil court system. The Egan case, one of the first heard in the courts of the New Territory, set the tone for resistance of outside authority with its slight understanding of an application to local circumstances and maximum extension of local control through the territorial legislature over the courts. All of these topics are, of course, of interest to Mormon historians as well as legal scholars. In addition to the above, the Egan case has implications for concern about the safety of immigrants to Utah. Then there are insights to be gained into Mormon ideas of morality. And underlying the events of the case are feminist insights on the role and status of women at the time. Analysis of the publications containing the George A. Smith argument and the Z. Snow jury instruction provides some insights into the morality and safety issues. The two documents seem to send opposite messages and yet are published, along with an editorial note by Willard Richards, hoping that their publication would, quote, provide a sufficient warning to all unchaste reprobates that they are not wanted in our community. The widespread publication of these documents was to serve as a notice that, quote, while Gentile society condoned extramarital sexual relations, Mormons limited their sexual relationships to the married state, albeit one man could have several wives, end of quote. This being a response to widespread reports of Mormon immorality before and after the church's announcement of plural marriage in 1852. Smith argues that in contrast to Great Britain with its 200,000 to 300,000 prostitutes, where the seducer pays a few pence in damages, in Utah, quote, men are under the necessity of respecting female chastity when a seducer is no more secure abroad than the dog that is found killing sheep, end of quote. At the same time that Smith reaffirms morality, Judge Snow's instructions reaffirm that there will be law and order and courts that exercise due process in the territory. He says, quote, the safety of ourselves individually and of society depends on the correct and faithful administration of good and wholesome laws. No one ought to be punished until he has had an opportunity of having a fair and impartial trial. Such a statement would later rest immigrants' fears that they would be greeted with frontier lawlessness in the new territory. Finally, the Egan case provides some insights into attitudes toward and treatment of women. It would certainly be interesting to see events through the eyes of Tamsin Egan. The paternalistic notion that men have a duty to guard the virtue of women at large is a recurrent theme in George A. Smith's argument. He characterized Monroe as, quote, a hyena that entered Egan's sheets, seduced his wife, and introduced a monster into his family, referring to the illegitimate child. Though this act was apparently consensual, Tamsin was forgiven, and Monroe was shot. In this regard, Cannon notes that no action for seduction could have been brought against Monroe. He notes that criminal statutes, including the one enacted by the territorial legislature in 1852 after the Egan case, require that the woman must be unmarried and of a previously chaste nature. He says that seduction is hard to prove, and further, that Tamsin had evidently not been an unwilling party to the liaison. Some note needs to be made about the crime of seduction as it was understood in 1851. Its earliest meaning was deprivation of a father of the services of a daughter or a master of his female servant with additional penalties for defiling her or contracting marriage without parental consent. Seduction, a statutory crime, usually required that the woman be unmarried and chaste. However, Bouvier's Law Dictionary, 1882, gives a definition of seduction as, quote, the act of a man in inducing a woman to commit unlawful sexual intercourse with him, with no requirement as to chastity or marital state, nor are they mentioned in some of the other criminal law sources. Criminal laws of the state of Deseret, passed January 16, 1851, section 22, does not define what acts constitute the crime of seduction, stating that, quote, if any man shall have sexual intercourse with any female not his wife, or shall seduce any female, he is subject to imprisonment, hard labor, private damages, and fine. Unlike statutes in other jurisdictions, however, women were subject to the same penalty. Quote, any female seducing or unlawfully cohabiting with a male shall receive the same punishment. Equality. In closing, it should be noted that Egan went on to an illustrious career as a drover and explorer who marked the central route to California. He established and maintained under contract numerous stations for the Overland Mail and later the Pony Express, occasionally driving the coach and even riding the ponies. He established as his headquarters a farm and general store at Deep Creek, now called Ibapah, and was a friend, mediator, and employer of the Goshute Indians. He developed a gold mine in the area, but lost his investment when he failed to attract the railroad line, which went north of the Great Salt Lake instead. He then returned to the old home in Salt Lake City in 1875, where he was employed as special guard to Brigham Young and nursed him through his final illness in 1877. Egan died in 1878 at the age of 63. Tamsin Egan had one more child, the last of six, in 1861. While her husband engaged in his exploits in California and the Deep Creek Valley, she raised her children and maintained her household near Union Square in Salt Lake City. This location was near the area where immigrants were quartered, some of them arriving in hand carts without the necessities of life. She expended much of the Egan wealth to help them, distributing $1,500 worth of provisions in one season. She died in 1805 at the age of 79. William M. Egan, the illegitimate son, published his stepfather's diaries in 1917. They don't mention the trial. Thank you.
Before beginning, I need to set the record straight on executed women. There have been none in Utah. There have been 38 since 1900 to about 3,000 men. There has been one to 250 since 1976. And I must take issue with the fact that women are better than men. It's just that they're not prosecuted as much in terms of the sentencing to execution, because as I understand it, the homicide arrest rate for women is identical to that of men. But that's another issue. I appreciate the chance to be here and to comment on Lee's paper. I think it's an exceptional paper, and I found it very interesting. I also found a quote. I found it was interesting. When someone protested at Pope Alexander IV's wholesale distribution of pardons for the most heinous crimes, one of which included the murder of a daughter by the father, he retorted easily, "It is not God's will that a sinner should die, but that he should live and pay." Now, it seems like Howard Egan got away with not having to live and pay, but I'm not sure that that could be said about Tamsin, and it would be very interesting to know what her life was like, and certainly those last years of hers giving money and aid to the homeless and those in need, I think, indicates there was a certain amount of penance that needed to be paid. The story that that Lee has provided for us, I think, is the stuff that soap operas are made of. If we could just sort of abbreviate it. Husband gone for months at a time. Wife takes in male school teacher as boarder. Boarder seduces lonely wife and sires bastard child. Male boarder leaves town. Husband returns home to surprise. Husband tracks down male boarder and shoots him in the name of the Lord. Husband found innocent. Wife confesses and does penance through her lifelong service. Bastard child disappears into the anonymity of history. You couldn't write a better screenplay, I don't think. And so maybe that would be the route to publish it, would be certainly in Hollywood. I think the story is not unusual for its time, but it is conceded that the verdict, as suggested, did spawn a rash of justifiable homicides within the next few years. Leah suggested that both legal scholars and historians would be particularly interested in this. I would like to suggest that he expand that a little bit and look at the interest that sociologists and criminologists would have in it, because I think it's fascinating. And so I would like to just add to what he has said several areas that piqued my interest and that tie in with a lot of the history, I think, of the state. One of the first areas that I found particularly relevant is the definitions of justice and the purpose of punishment as practiced in this early history. It seems that justice in those days had some sense of fairness and some universal sense of balance. That does not seem to be the case now. Justice, as we define it now, seems to be a matter of process and structure rather than any sense of fairness. In the Egan case, there was a sensitivity to the prevention of seducers and others coming into the territory and feeling free to explore the charms of married Utah women. And one doesn't have to ponder too long to look at what the implications would be were the editorial from the Deseret News and the comments of George A. Smith, as already indicated, a man who seduces a woman ought to pay the penalty with his life, and her nearest relative should bring him to account. It would not take very long for us to reduce the crime rate, in one sense, were we to practice this kind of a policy. And I think it's this unique sense of justice that must have influenced several things in Utah. One of them, I think, has to do with returning, as in the case of John D. Lee, returning the murderer to the site of the crime to be executed. Also, the instance in this state where we executed a horse. Our sense of justice is sort of interesting as to how we do that. I have to tell you that Utah is not unique in that extent. In Irwin, Tennessee, in 1914, an elephant was executed. Murderess Mary was hanged from a railroad derrick for killing her trainer. The chain broke the first time, and they had to do it again. So much for the broken rope pardon. That did not happen. I just recently returned from Russia, where I found that a bell, because it was rung to announce the beginning of the assassination of one of the czars, was banished to Siberia, where it was kept for 150 years, later being returned, having paid its penalty, and rededicated and hung in the belfry again. And last year in China, we found several statues which had been present at the killing of one of the Chinese officials, and so they had all been wooden statues, had been taken out and beheaded as punishment. So there are some interesting things, I think, in terms of Utah and what constitutes justice and what constitutes punishment and how it's inflicted and how it's presented. And I think the Egan case is one of those where we suggest that the unwritten law is more powerful than the written law. I also found it interesting to look at the early attitudes towards law. Certainly the Mormon experience bred a distrust for the legal authorities and the political process. Coming across the plains, the ecclesiastical order was that which superseded anything in terms of the laws of the land. We are told that Lee, that Egan was exonerated by a church court before he ever went to trial. My understanding is that this is not the process now, that church courts are held after the legal process has taken its just punishment. But there has always been in the state, I think, a difficult balance between church and state. And obviously this was one instance. It has changed. It has evolved as the state has gone along. I think the state still struggles with it. I think it became very apparent in a case similar to the Egan case. It was not exactly that, but let me talk about both of these. The first one has to do with a trial for a man by the name of Mortensen, who was eventually executed. He had been suspected and accused of killing a man who owed him some money, and the man brought the money and then disappeared, and they never saw him again, and then eventually several weeks later the body was found. As the trial occurred, the father-in-law of the man who was killed, the father-in-law of the victim, was testifying, and testified to the fact, when asked how he knew that Mortensen was the killer, testified to the fact that he had received a revelation. And in this revelation, he had seen bloody footsteps leading from the grave of his son-in-law to Mortensen's home. And it was interesting to see Joseph F. Smith, then prophet of the church, jump in and make a quick statement. Let me just quote that. And this comes from the juvenile instructor, 15th of February, 1902. Recently, a man charged with the murder of another man was examined before a committing magistrate in Salt Lake City. The father-in-law of the murdered man, during the examination on the part of the state, laid the crime at the door of the accused. In the cross-examination, the attorney for the defendant pressed the witness as to how he knew that the accused was guilty of the crime. The reply, as given in the press, was because God had revealed it to him. Again, still quoting Joseph F. Smith, it does not appear from the further proceedings in the case that the testimony was accepted to or withdrawn, or that the magistrate informed the witness that such evidence was incompetent and could not be received. No member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints should for one moment regard such testimony as admissible in a court of law. And to make the case perfectly clear, it may be further stated that such evidence would not be permissible even in a church court. Any attempt, therefore, to make it appear that such evidence is in keeping with the tenets of the Mormon faith is wholly unjustified. And so here you have an attempt to more definitely clarify the relationship between church and state, which I think was not clear necessarily in the Egan case, certainly as you look at those who were on the jury and the judges and others. Just as an aside to the Mortensen case, I might suggest Mortensen was not a very popular man anyway. People were glad to see him executed. While sitting on death row, all of the other inmates made their escape, got a key, let everybody out except Mortensen. They left him there to his fate. So there was not a lot of sympathy for that man. The third issue I think that Lee's paper brings out is the idea of guilt or innocence and how it's established. We had a wonderful description of the crime, and even in spite of that, we had the judge's instructions, and we still had the jury deciding on some other factors, whatever those are. And I'm not sure how guilt or innocence is established. It used to be that if the offender was dipped in boiling oil and came back out without being dead, this was a sure sign of his innocence, or held under the water for several hours and then came back, was still considered innocent. That was the proof. Many attempts have been made to establish how we would go about this. Lombroso and Hollywood seem to think we can do it on physical features and characteristics. That was also true in the early history of Utah. Phrenology was used as a way of identifying whether a person was guilty or not, or what their characteristics were. And even at the prison, rather than characterizing people by fingerprints, which we did not have at that time, they were characterized and categorized by phrenology, by a phrenology chart. One of the cases in Utah described a murder as follows. In all the annals of criminals, we know of no cranium or physiology which gives better proof of an innate criminal than those of our subject. His whole physique bore testimony to the truth of the science of phrenology. He was wanting in ideality and imagination. This want saved him from the anguish that a sensitive person would have suffered in his situation, the certain approach of a felon's doom. So his wants were supplied. He could be merry over his coffin. And in another interesting case, the case of Charles Dutch Charlie Botha, his sentence was commuted to life. Crime similar to Egan's, returned from a trip. His 15-year-old wife had been seduced by the neighbor. He killed them both, but we're now in 1904, and so he was sentenced to die. And it's interesting to follow the historical sequence as to how much tolerance there was for these things. But he appealed his sentence to the Board of Pardons. Board of Pardons met and commuted his sentence. And this is the statement. During the hearing before the board, it was argued Botha had no other motive in his crime than to protect his home and wife's chastity. Since he killed his wife first, it was argued that the shots were fired randomly. Otherwise, the man would have been killed first. According to experts at the hearing, it has never occurred in human history that a man under such circumstances would kill his wife first and then kill the destroyer of his home. So the evidence to commute the sentence was that the woman had been killed first, and therefore it was a random killing. But we still had the death sentence. It was just commuted to life in prison, and of course Egan did not suffer any of that. I think there are some questions that I would like to see Lee further address, and those have to do with some of the criminological and sociological issues as well as the legal issues. On the other hand, I guess my sociological interest leads me more in a personal direction. I'd like to know more about the accomplice. I don't see anything in the paper that indicates what happened to the accomplice that was charged along with Egan in this instance. And I would also like to know more about the victim, the school teacher, how he came to be here, who he was, what he was doing, that type of thing. And also more about William Egan, the child, what his life was like, where it led him, what kind of prejudice he ran into, if there was any, or whether this issue was totally glossed over, how he fit into the family. It seems that he would have been the fifth child, if I count correctly, whether he was accepted, whether he was an outcast. It could have been a disaster at family reunions, I imagine. and I don't know where that is now or where that genealogy is. And it was interesting to me to note almost an implication that if you were a man, sort of a macho implication of the unwritten law, that if you were a man and your wife were seduced and you did not kill the seducer, your reputation in the community would be worthless. And it was almost an obligation to carry this through. So there's several really interesting issues, I think, still left that could be dealt with as an addition to the paper. I find it fascinating, always have. Murder is one of those things that sort of captivates me, and hope it captivates you. Not sure I understand it, not sure I ever will. In conclusion, let me just suggest that Utah really is a fun and an interesting place to live. And its history tends to be a history of attempting to find a balance, I think, a balance between church and state, Mormon and Gentile, justice and law, individual rights and the rights of society. And I think that attempt to find that balance continues even today. I doubt that it will ever end, but studying the process certainly never gets boring. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee, and thank you, Kay. Would you like to address some of Lee's questions for us, and then we'll take some questions from the audience if we have time?
Thanks for your critique, Kay, and a couple of the questions I can respond to just a little bit. As far as what happened to Thurston, the accomplice, because this was the crime he was charged with was not murder, but aiding and abetting, the case against him was dismissed. I wish I knew more about Thurston. He seems to be one of these sort of rough-and-tumble frontier types, which Egan was, of course. Egan was not an educated man. His experience was as a sailor and as an explorer, as a cattle drover, a horseman, a rough-and-tumble outdoorsman type. And I think that Thurston was like that. I see Thurston as probably being sort of a cowboy. I don't know too much about him, and I found very little, although I made an attempt to find out more about Thurston. Monroe, actually, there's quite a bit about Monroe in the literature. Monroe made his appearance in early church history. He taught school in Nauvoo. He was apparently a fairly well-respected citizen in the community. And as a schoolmaster, it was pretty common that he would move from family to family and board with families. That was typically the way of taking care of a schoolmaster. It doesn't appear, I didn't find anything that indicated that Monroe had a family or had been married or anything about his family life. Although I think that that probably exists in available documents. As far as William Egan, from accounts in the publication of the Egan Diaries, which is just a little short book and also contains a lot of other narratives from other children of Howard Egan, it appears that William was well accepted as a member of the family. And I think the fact that he published the Egan Diaries and did the compilation of Egan papers in 1917 indicates that he was well accepted into the family, and that there was that he was not rejected as a child. And certainly he appears in the Tamson-Egan household in a number of anecdotal incidents that are included in the little Egan biography and diaries book. And again, on Tamson, I think it would be interesting if we could find a diary or something about Tamson. But so far I haven't found anything that's extant on Tamson. It would be, maybe the Egan family has something that would elucidate that for us. But these are absolutely fascinating people. It's just the story of this family is just absolutely compelling. The time they spent at winter quarters while Howard was out guiding the first party, captain of the 9th 10 under Brigham Young, he was driving someone else's wagon, driving the wagon of a widow. In his party, in his 10, was also William Clayton and Heber C. Kimball, whom he called father. Very interesting, very, very fascinating individual. You know, not just in terms of the murder, but his whole life. It's just a terrific chapter in the history of the territory. Other questions?
Was I correct in
No. Hosea Stout was present as an observer. And Hosea Stout wrote quite a bit in his journal. There's a journal entry right after the murder occurred. And then there are several entries during the days that the court was in session and that the trial occurred. And he indicates that he was in court and observed the trial. His A.J. Stout, his younger brother. Yes. Yes. Yes.
You mentioned that we don't know what the basis for the jury's verdict was in the case. Wouldn't it be safe to assume that with publicity of the case conceived, just pure speculation or safe speculation, that they had to base it on the jurisdictional issue because if any prosecutor in a hypothetical defense case like that should have moved for a directed verdict, had they believed that their decision was based on something other than jurisdictional?
I wish we had some indication of what went on in the jury room, and I've researched the journals as far as I could find them of individual jury members, hoping that I would find some indication, as well as the diaries kept by Seth Blair, and no indication of why. I would think it had to be jurisdictional. I mean, that's what comes out of the record for me, is that it was jurisdictional. Although there is no concrete evidence to tell you that. Yeah, I don't have enough experience in criminal procedure or what the procedure would have been at that time. But I think in a modern court, dismissal could occur at any point in the trial. This can be brought up as grounds for dismissal. And I think that it depends on when that is brought up as an issue, whether or not jeopardy has attached. If it's after jeopardy has attached, then there'd have to be an acquittal, even, I think, in a modern trial. Because of double jeopardy. Yes, Gary. Well, that's what was available, actually. There are a couple of people who I can't really identify who they are in terms of relationship to the church or the community. But most of the people on the jury are recognizable as pioneers and people in the community who are, you know, fairly active church people. And I don't think that it was really stacked. I think that that's what the community was, that in 1851 you really don't have much of a Gentile presence in the valley yet. Yes. Well, the unwritten law that I think you're referring to is this concept of mountain common law, which George A. Smith argues is not just mountain common law, but this is customary, and this is the practice that's fairly widespread all through the states, all through America, except for some jurisdictions, and he mentioned specifically Ohio, where they have chosen to follow the English common law. But the custom and practice elsewhere seems to have been that, yes, this is really what happened, is that that shooting a seducer was justifiable. And they followed that. They followed that until the turn of the century, at least. That the courts found that sort of homicide to be justifiable, at least in Utah, and probably in the other states, too. Yes?
Yes.
Will you talk with me afterward for a minute? I'd like to make that contact. Good, thank you. Other questions?
I would like to know from that common law was widely accepted in the valley, but from the beginning, did the community feel that that was a legitimate form of justice?
Yes. Yes, they were comfortable with that. That does seem to have been the custom and practice, and that's something that they brought with them from the States. You know, that was as Kay's pointed out, that was justice. You know, to our modern minds, it's vigilante justice, and it's that model, that preventative model that I was talking about, and it is it's. As our criminal justice system seems to be deteriorating, I think we're seeing a return to that. We're seeing neighborhood watch, and we're seeing people in the community become involved in law enforcement in a way that they haven't been since police forces came into vogue just about the time this was happening. You know, we didn't have an organized police force until about the 1850s, 1860s coming in.
Okay.
Thank you.